The following presentation may not be suitable for young children. Listener discretion is advised. Vladimir Levin, in October of 1993, is a man on the verge of history. When the Minesweeper program pops up via remote access, on his own computer screen, Vladimir feels a dilated rush of adrenaline split his bloodstream. Little flags and hidden bombs. Vladimir grips the edge of his mouse with a sweaty palm and pulls his rolling chair closer beneath the desk. Is this it? Is this how LAN networks connect? No way it's that easy. But this mysterious Russian isn't interested in mind-numbing games. He's looking for confirmation that his computer system has accessed the Citibank central processors. And after seeing the rectangular game screen pop up, it's only a few clicks before Vladimir has bombed the Minesweeper screen and is well on his way to exploding the private accounts of one of America's largest financial institutions. The early days of the internet were, in many ways, a sped-up reflection of human civilization's complex dynamics. Built for all, the intention was open access and collaborative code. When the internet first began allowing remote access, there isn't much thought to the need for security. With only a few hundred active users and little to do beyond sending emails or low-res images, encryption and access were low priority. Vladimir's eyes dart across the screen. The numbers are whizzing across it. Click, click. It's a different game of Minesweeper now, and Vladimir's been waiting to play it since he first gained access to the Citibank servers over 6 months ago. What are those numbers? Accounts or dollar amounts? Even as Hollywood brought the internet mainstream with thrillers like The Net and The Saint, average consumers had no idea how the technology functions. An exception to this is Vladimir Levin, whose cold calculation sees opportunity, nothing more. Within a matter of months, Vladimir, with no previous coding, hacking, or remote access experience, will steal over $10 million from Citibank, siphoning funds remotely from business and private accounts indiscriminately. With no federal cyber task force in existence, international governments scramble to react. Like a surprise attack from unknown technology, the hack exposes issues within the corporate tech sector, heretofore unknown or considered. With millions floating off the grid, authorities have no answers. Vladimir begins his 1994 invasion of Citibank with a game of Minesweeper. But it won't be long before it becomes a minefield, one that only grows more confusing as the truth is pulled into light. On this episode, an administrator turned hacker, a multi-million dollar betrayal, and the world's first online hack that happened offline. I'm Keith Korneluk, and you're listening to a bonus episode of Modem Mischief. You're listening to Modem Mischief. In this series, we explore the darkest reaches of the internet. We'll take you into the minds of the world's most notorious hackers and the lives affected by them. We'll also show you places you won't find on Google and what goes on down there. This is the story of Vladimir Levin. In 1991, when Vladimir Levin first heard about the internet, he was standing over a meager folding table proffering crackers and cheese at a programmers conference in St. Petersburg. Vladimir, a mathematics graduate himself, liked numbers and their dependability. This internet sounded fascinating. An extended network of computers communicating in binary code via telephone lines. The room was abuzz with implications, theories, and predictions as to what the future of the internet might hold. Vladimir Levin was born in St. Petersburg, the son of two teachers. Bookish by nature, he had a propensity towards creating structure from chaos and loved the order afforded by mathematics and its sequencing. His work as a programmer, though monotonous, felt empowering to him. He understood the power of computers in a time when the technology was moving far faster than the public's understanding of it. Put simply, Vladimir Levin was a geek, but a cool one. The early 90s were a pretty great time to be a geek. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Urkel, and Encarta all dragged a different type of hero into the mainstream, the thinking man. Plus, computers were simply cool. Like a gaming console, but more powerful, the home computer opened up the public to appreciate this kind of technology while paving the way for the next exit on the information superhighway, public access internet. For Vladimir Levin, the early 90s were not only a great time to be a geek, but to be one in Russia. The fall of the USSR was a slow, brittle slide into recession and economic anemia within the country. Yet this moment in time marked an enormous opportunity in certain growing industries like computer technologies. Levin's skill set of being a highly competent mathematician and an enormous computer junkie will soon be in high demand. Most of Levin's weekday is spent in the office at a computer programming firm fixing lines of ones and zeros. Levin works methodically, and it isn't until his commute home on the tram that Vladimir's true passion enters focus: hacking. An avid reader of Frack, an early 90s magazine specializing in breaking down computers and computer servers, Vladimir consumes the monthly magazine a dozen times over before the next issue hits the back of his mailbox. Vladimir, though obsessed with hacking, is no hacker himself. Yet his imagination runs wild as he watches the cityscape give way to the suburb. "I wouldn't do it, though. I never would. But I could. It'd be easy, too. I just need the right servers to access." This era of early internet access was run on computers often operating on open access servers, meaning that anyone with a network code could access shared servers and information contained within. It was simply presumed that a 16 or 24-digit ID code was security enough, and many weak points that would be exploited by hackers, like stealing information from a hard drive's cache or remote accessing a network, hadn't been identified as weak spots yet. For hackers in the 90s, they are often the smartest person in the room, or in the server, so to speak. If you understand the technical how-tos involved in a computer accessing a broader online network, you are in the vast minority. Most people knew how to turn computers on, access a program or two, and then turn them off. Vladimir Levin is both interested in this new gray frontier, known as computer hacking, and highly proficient as a mathematician and programmer. By early 1993, Vladimir had graduated from simply obsessing over each issue of Frack to meeting up at some of the quarterly get-togethers. The largest such gatherings are in New York and San Francisco, but not far behind is St. Petersburg. The Soviets' growing obsession with computers are now extending to the criminal sector, too. But Vladimir Levin isn't a criminal. No, he's just a programmer, interested in learning more. As he steps off the tram a block away from the tea house that will host the St. Petersburg Cloister of Frack subscribers, Vladimir feels his palms grow clammy. "Why do I feel so guilty? This is interesting. Not criminal. I mean, I'm here to learn." The cigarette smoke mixes with the sharp floral scent of herbal tea. As Vladimir looks around, he doesn't see men in trench coats, but rather, people much like himself. He's greeted with warmth and a few cries of, "Frack, huh?" to which Vladimir can't help but smile. He's found his tribe. In 1993, the internet doesn't function like it does now. Back then, accessing the internet meant accessing specific servers via your telephone modem. One of the first and largest servers was called SprintNet. If you knew secondhand about a site on SprintNet, you could enter it manually and hope for the best. It was a complicated system, especially by modern standards, that if executed correctly, would lead a user to a type of online message board. It is a novelty, especially for communicating long distance, but generally unexciting and hard to navigate. Yet lounging in the hazy tea room, these frackophiles can't believe their eyes. The atmosphere is bubbling, kinetic, combustible. The latest issue came out that same day, so there's much to discuss. In this March issue, the magazine releases an enormous, near-comprehensive listing of all known SprintNet servers. The list is organized by state and company: Lincoln Financial, Indiana; Finley Fine Jewelry Corp., New York; and one company boasting 363 different online locations: Citibank. For all these internet aficionados, it's as if they've been driving in a foreign city and finally been given GPS coordinates. The group's list of accessible online servers has increased by 400% instantly. For the majority of people in this room, the list of SprintNet servers is exciting and interesting. But for Vladimir Levin, it's the push from programmer to hacker. Vladimir Levin nearly burns his tongue on his tea, absentmindedly. His mind is already flying, fingers itching, to see where this digital rabbit hole will lead. As conversation drifts elsewhere, Vladimir slips onto the streets of St. Petersburg. beelining for his computer modem to enter these new online destinations. Slowly, meticulously, like a phone stalker calling and hanging up, Vladimir will haunt these access servers until he finds an open door. For the first 7 or 8 months, Vladimir lives like a fly on a Citibank wall. Many of the servers listed in the frack list deny him access, but others are accessible. Vladimir dials in from across the Atlantic to Citibank computers across multiple continents, listening, waiting, and learning very little. Oftentimes, numerous SprintNet servers for Citibank computers are inaccessible without a password. However, one day, Vladimir catches a break. A Citibank server that normally denies him access is open.
Oh my God, wait, can I see the password?
He's shocked. He's been trying to access this Citibank server and has been denied access countless times. But today, he catches a break. For what reason? A computer malfunction? A screensaver that didn't click on in time? A lunch break taken early or running long? It's to this day unknown. But Vladimir doesn't care as to why. Though it's pressing past midnight and his morning commute will be a painful one, Vladimir works through the night, pressing, prying into the Citibank server. In a few keystrokes, Vladimir has requested access to view the password for the login and been granted it. His mind is racing as he's now connected through his SprintNet modem in St. Petersburg to his Citibank computer processing over $2 billion in transfers daily. Vladimir begins retroactively using the login and password to see what other Citibank servers he can access. And sure enough, he's granted into dozens. Inventory, personal, and accounts. The volume of transfers is staggering. Surely one rogue transfer won't be noticed, right? The cigarette breaks become longer at work, as Vladimir can't stop imagining a different life for himself. One free of the economic chains of the 9-to-5. He'll buy a home for his parents and family. Maybe somewhere beautiful like the Balkans. His tram rides to the computer programming firm feel more and more claustrophobic and unnecessary. At night, Vladimir's real work begins. Using his new login and password to access and monitor dozens of online Citibank computers, he watches the whizzing numbers like a hungry lion watching a gazelle. It is not a matter of if, but when. After several more months of simply waiting, watching, and deepening his understanding of Citibank's online networks and the computer therein, Vladimir is ready to take his real plan worldwide. He has a friend in St. Petersburg, a neurosurgeon in fact, who's found his side business working as a computer parts distributor so lucrative that the surgeon quit his job to sell computers full-time. Such is the tech fever rushing through St. Petersburg. Vladimir's accomplice agrees to go to Finland, and Vladimir wants to reroute his transfer to an account in neither of their names. This former brain surgeon boards a plane for Finland and awaits the go-ahead from Vladimir. Vladimir Levin, fully aware of the line being crossed, moves from armchair hacker to criminal. In a few buzzing hums of the computer modem, Vladimir's connected, via SprintNet, to the Citibank computer console responsible for over $1 billion daily in cash management and transfer. A few clicks on the keyboard, and Vladimir will be a very rich man. There aren't enough cigarettes in the world to calm Vladimir's mind. He's done. The keystrokes entered. The commands executed. $400,000 US has been rerouted from a private Citibank account to a private Finnish account. Vladimir almost jumps out of his seat when his landline phone erupts, the electronic bleeding breaking the silence and Vladimir's own internal monologue of anxiety. It's the surgeon. He's in Finland, unmolested by the police, and he's $400,000 richer. Did they hesitate? Well, ask any questions then? Nothing? It's almost too easy. But for a boy whose life wasn't always that way, he's not one to question it. Vladimir quickly liquidates the transfer over the following weeks, moving from digital theft to real-world cash. He's elated and quits his job. The vibrancy and color of the world around him is unsurpassed. He's done it. Vladimir Levin's entire life has shifted in an afternoon. More than 4,000 miles away, the Citibank IT staff in Chicago, Illinois, is buzzing like an upturned anthill. Though they weren't able to freeze the transfer in time, there was a rogue reroute that caught the eye of Citibank IT personnel. It's not unusual for an account to transfer a significant sum to a new account that's never been referenced or connected. But for a high-volume account to empty itself into a foreign account with no previous ties or connections has immediately raised alarm bells. Internally, Citibank is struggling to identify the root of the issue. It's 1994, and there have been exactly zero high-profile digital thefts. So looking for the culprit online is vague and low priority. As Vladimir Levin is being tailored for dinner jackets, the IT team at Citibank is entering hour 13 of emergency protocol. As the Citibank brass continues to grasp for answers, there are those at the company who wish to bring in the FBI and American law enforcement. Either by luck or by genius, Vladimir has stumbled into the electronic back door to one of America's largest financial institutions. Citibank is hesitant to sound the alarm publicly because of the reputational fallout. In short, a bank's number one job is to avoid using people's money. And right, wrong, or indifferent, Citibank's image with the public at large will undoubtedly take a hit. Without any other options, and desperate to avoid another hit, Citibank calls in the FBI. Across the Atlantic, his belly fat and ego stroked, Vladimir Levin prepares to take things up a level. Confident that he's pulled off a heist undetected, Vladimir scales up, reaching out to a local St. Petersburg fixer with ties to a crime family called the Tambov family. Connected and skilled at laundering money, it felt like a perfect fit. The Tambov family would front the cost of flying people to foreign countries and the setting up of foreign bank accounts. The system set, the Tambov contacts prepared to receive another transfer, this time in Buenos Aires. Vladimir logs into the SprintNet server as he has 1,000 or more times. But this moment feels different. He knows he's going back, reaching again into the honeypot. But he's gotten away with it once, he'll do it again. As the keystrokes fell in sequence, the SprintNet system for Citibank reroutes over $1 million to a bank account in Argentina. As Russian goons and one nervous programmer await receipt and withdrawal, the IT staff at Citibank is ready. They're looking for it this time, and immediately contact the FBI, who freezes the account. At the first sign of trouble, the Russian asset on the ground in Argentina bails, hightailing it out of the bank before Argentinian police can respond. It's a clear flop, one that undoubtedly tested the newly forged alliance between Levin and Tambov family. Unknown to Levin is the fact that his actions have triggered a butterfly effect that will change the structure of American intelligence and global policing. Unfazed, Vladimir Levin promises an even bigger score and pushes himself up to and beyond his breaking point.
I'm sure it was just a glitch. We got unlucky. I know it works. I need one more.
But the Tambov family aren't amateurs, and patient isn't their commodity. Vladimir decides to double down, his $400,000 score now encored by two failed transfers of over $1 million each. Vladimir is nervous, unsure of the flaw in his plan. The casual assurances leave his lips but don't reach his eyes. He is a man unsure if he's getting unlucky or if he already got lucky. It's a fine line to find. Levin concocts a new plan. Instead of running one rogue transfer, he will initiate several, say half a dozen, to create a web of transfers that will be harder to track and penetrate. Unbeknownst to Vladimir, Citibank has been working with the FBI for the past several months, who in turn, after recognizing the novelty and impacts of the crimes, have created a cyber task force. It's the first of its kind, and it deals with lawlessness in this strange place called the internet. But Vladimir has no idea Citibank is onto him. The transfers are working, the money's getting out, but when Tambov contacts go to pick up the money from the bank, the account has been suspended. Vladimir thinks he's catching a bad break. After all, it worked the first time. Little does he know, the net is closing. Before the big push, Vladimir has accounts opened in San Francisco, five in fact. By redirecting and sending multiple transfers, Vladimir hopes to confuse Citibank IT staff long enough to make the withdrawal. The transfers go on without a hitch, and the contact, a Russian woman on holiday with her husband, goes to make the withdrawal. Levin feels the heat on his fingertips from the cigarette he forgot was there, his eyes glued to his computer screen for confirmation of a withdrawal. He waits and waits, his pulse quickening into a roar. The tension builds until he can't take it. Though it's the middle of the night in St. Petersburg, Vladimir calls San Francisco.
What's going on? Is it done? Are you out? The transfer went through. What's going on?
The woman on holiday was told by the bank branch in San Francisco she'll need to come back the next day. Her flight, meant to leave that evening, is postponed. However, her husband flies back, not wanting to pay for the change of flight fee. The next day, instead of cash being put into her hands, handcuffs are being put onto them. Her flight, change fee or not, will be to New York City and a federal holding cell. What unfolds next is a quick and comprehensive unraveling. Yevgeny Korlakov, the husband in question who has left his wife to be detained by the FBI, returns from Russia and quickly turns, agreeing to call Vladimir Lenin on a recorded line. Vladimir reaches for his Motorola, unaware it's soon to be the device of his own demise. Levin incriminates himself repeatedly, and the feds have everything they need except for Levin. Russia doesn't extradite its citizens, so the United States military and FBI agents will have to get lucky. Perhaps someday they will. But in the meantime, Vladimir ratchets up his transfer attempts, totaling $10 million over the next 6 months. Each attempt is caught by the ever more vigilant IT staff, who alert the FBI, though neither can trace Lenin's location. His options running as thin as his dwindling resources, Levin attempts to relocate to Holland and a Dutch connection that can potentially disguise Vladimir's transfers to allow for withdrawal. This desperate push gives authorities the break they need. As Vladimir Lenin's flight changes planes in London, English authorities are more than happy to cooperate. After fighting extradition and losing, Vladimir must face the levied consequences. He's convicted of theft and fraud. The majority of his transfer attempts fruitless, his path a ruined wake of arrested associates and Tambov family members. As the years tick by, Vladimir Lenin's story seems unresolved. 3 years in prison, $250,000 in restitution, after which the world's first internet thief just disappears. But blog posts in the early 2000s contradict Lenin's official account, describing him as more of a systems administrator than programmer incapable of such a sophisticated theft. Echoes of rumor speculated that Levin didn't actually use the internet at all for his hacks, but rather had access to telephone lines where he'd eavesdrop on Citibank customers to gain account access. Or perhaps the truth lies somewhere in between. Such is Vladimir Lenin, a mystery. I'm Keith Korneluk, and you're listening to a bonus episode of Modem Mischief. Thanks for listening to this bonus episode of Modem Mischief. If you're hearing this show, then that means you're supporting us on Patreon or a paid subscription on Apple Podcasts, and we're grateful as all hell for you. Modem Mischief is brought to you by Mad Dragon Productions and is created, produced, and hosted by me, Keith Korneluk. This episode is written and researched by John Phillips, mixed and mastered by David Swope. The theme song You Are Digital is composed by Computer Bandit. And don't forget to follow us on social media at Modem Mischief. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.